in this address, I'm going to speak a little about the pre-1950 situation, then the men and the movements, and then make some assessment of it. First of all then, the pre-1950 situation, the state of the church. It was a time when the baneful effects of higher criticism which arose in Germany the previous century were working itself out in the churches. All the leading denominations were departing from their roots. C.H. Spurgeon fought a great battle in what became known as the downgrade controversy. Towards the end of his life, he was regarded as the last of the Puritans. He declared, "What has been done today will affect the next centuries. For my part, I'm quite willing to be eaten of dogs for the next 50 years, but the more distant future will vindicate me." How true. Much of the damage was done through the theological colleges. This was true in England and in Scotland. Many who adopted a quite radical, critical view of the Bible still claimed to believe the same old gospel truths that they had learned from their childhood. They retained the devotional language. Conservative evangelical students were frequently subjected to ridicule by fellow students and often by their tutors. Few came out of their theological education totally unscathed. The only textbooks available were in the liberal tradition. Conservative students had to scour the second-hand bookshops for copies of Dale on the Atonement, Denny on the Death of Death, and commentaries by Lightfoot, Ryle, and Handley Moore. Liberalism was a discontinuity from the historical Christian faith. That faith, with its magnificent view of the Christian religion that had captivated men's hearts, that had triumphed over darkness and error, that had transformed individuals and families and nations. It was summarized by B.B. Warfield. It begins, its centers, and it ends with a vision of God and His glory, and itself sets itself before all things to render to God His rights in every sphere of life activity. Liberalism was just disguised unbelief. It made religion man-centered. It assumed the goodness of human nature and portrayed Christianity in terms of doing rather than believing. The business of religion is to support people, to comfort people. In essence, liberalism was Christianity harmonized with the religious aspirations of all men. It was truth modified to give offense to none. Liberalism gained its hold in Protestant churches because good men feared that unless concessions were made to the latest scholarship, the churches would lose their place in the modern world. That was the liberalism that affected the churches in that time. Well, the evangelicalism that prevailed from late Victorian times to the 1950s retained the essentials of the gospel. It believed that men's souls are lost, that conversion is an indispensable necessity, that separation from the world and holiness of life should characterize the Christian. But increasingly, in the evangelical world, there was less emphasis on doctrine. It gave less and less attention to the heritage of Reformed Christianity. The Reformers and Puritans were practically forgotten. The vision of God in His glory was rapidly disappearing from view, and evangelicalism itself became more and more man-centered. There was little interest, if any, in revival. And that was the state of the churches prior to 1950. Now, during the first 50 years, there were attempts to stem the tide and to reverse the trend. There was, of course, the exposure of the old liberalism in the First World War. It really dented men's views of the hope they had that this liberalism was going to bring peace and order to the world. But then there was the rise of neo-orthodoxy under Barth and Brunner. But that also failed. And among the existing reform men, for example, There was the launch of the Evangelical Quarterly in January 1929 under the joint editorship of Professor John R. Mackay and Professor Donald MacLean of the Free Church College. They sought to rally reform men around the world. And a leading article in the first issue of the Evangelical Quarterly was by Caspar Wister Hodge of Princeton on Reformed faith. And he begins by saying, "Doubtless this Reformed faith is suffering a decline in the theological world today. What has been termed Reformed springtime in Germany, we cannot regard as a legitimate daughter of the classical Reformed faith." He's referring to Barthianism, of course. Well, having dealt with that, I would like to mention one or two of the links and forerunners of this reformed recovery that took place in the 1950s. And the first man to mention is A.W. Pink. I like to think of A.W. Pink as a link between the Calvinism of Spurgeon and the rediscovery of the doctrines of grace under the ministry of Dr. Lloyd-Jones. His life spanned a half century. Converted in his hometown of Nottingham in 1908, he went to the USA in 1910 to the Moody Bible Institute, but only remained a few months before taking up a pastorate. Studying the Scofield Reference Bible and holding to the fundamentalism of that day, Pink went forth to preach. Quite soon, however, doubt about these accepted beliefs set in. The instrumental cause appears to have been the writings of the leaders of historic Christianity. The first of the new authors to unsettle him was Jonathan Edwards. Other authors of the same school drew his attention, and he went back afresh to the Bible. Pink was brought to the same discovery that the young Spurgeon made in his grandfather's study at Stambourne. As he read, the more convinced he became that it was not the old liberalism that was endangering the Christian faith, but fundamentalism with its man-centered programs for soul winning was also adrift. In the providence of God, Pink's first venture into printing caught the attention of a tract and Bible distributor, I.C. Herendeen, whose depot was at Swengle in Pennsylvania. He went to visit Pink in 1917, and the two men discovered how they had been led to a common mind with regard to the foremost weaknesses of contemporary Christianity. The immediate outcome was two books from Pink's pen, Divine Inspiration of the Bible, and then in June 1918, The Sovereignty of God, the most crucial publication to appear in the first half of the 20th century. In the foreword he writes, "It would be foolish for us to expect that this work will meet with general approval. The trend of modern theology, if theology it can be called, is ever toward the deification of the creature rather than the glorification of the creator." There was insight away back in 1918. It was to be another 40 years before the truth that Pink discovered was to gain more widespread acceptance. With this change reflected in his preaching, Pink was unable to find any church that wanted his services. Now, as you know, those of you who know much about Pink, perhaps there were other reasons in some cases why his services were not wanted, but basically it was because of the message that he was now proclaiming. And in 1922, he began a small magazine, Studies in the Scripture. It pointed its readership back to an understanding of the gospel that had barely been heard since the days of C.H. Spurgeon. This magazine and the titles printed from it became a major element in the recovery of the doctrines of grace, expository preaching, and biblical living. At the time of Pink's death in 1952, in virtual isolation in Stornoway — I don't mean Stornoway is isolated, but he was isolated in Stornoway — his magazine was feeding several of the men who were leading a return to doctrinal Christianity. And it's interesting, I'll be speaking later about Kenneth McCrae, and so fascinating to think about these two men in Stornoway at that time, and they never met. And they both had their part to play in the recovery of Reformed faith. Just another link and forerunner, and that is J. Green and the Sovereign Grace Book Club. A.W. Pink was blessed with a publisher who shared his convictions. I.C. Herendeen and the Bible Truth Depot made a significant contribution to the recovery of Calvinistic teaching. His successor was Don Reiner. He began working for Herendeen in the early 1950s and then bought him out and renamed the publishing work as Reiner Publications. A new figure came on the scene in the person of J. Green. He had no formal theological training, but filled with a zeal to reprint the writings of the old divines and promote them by mail order. He is supposed to have taken Mr. Herendeen's mailing list to begin his operation. He began the reprints without much attention to style or presentation, and up to 100 titles were produced and sold cheaply. An agent for the Sovereign Grace Book Club was appointed in England. He was T.E. Watson in Southampton, and his mailing describes this: an American project in which several hundred Christians have joined together in order to publish the best books of bygone days. It is not necessary to join the book club to purchase publications, which may be obtained in the usual way from the British agent T. E. Watson. All SGBC books are uniformly bound, gold letters on green binding, and most of them are sold without a dust cover. And you probably have some of them on your shelves. And if you want to look at the things there, there's some information about Sovereign Grace Book Club. I used to order from them in the early days. And of course, J. Green, unfortunately, was not, although he had zeal and earnestness and that, he was not very good in the financial realm. And he got into trouble. He was in debt and he had to be rescued. And he had several projects on his hands, book projects, but none of them have really come to much. I understand that he's still alive in America in his mid-80s at the present time. Well, then I move on to the men and the movements. It is clear that by the mid-20th century, a sea change was taking place. Addressing the annual meeting of the Evangelical Library in 1955, Dr. Lloyd-Jones speaks of that change. I feel that we are witnessing a true revival of interest in the Puritans, and a number of young men are studying their literature constantly. There is held annually a Puritan conference which is attended by some 60 people, and this library has played a very central part in it. The next year, Dr. Lloyd-Jones went to the United States, and he was greatly encouraged to see a very similar thing happening in the USA. Now, in tracing the development of the movement, I will look at the way in which men from different backgrounds were themselves captured by the teaching and then went on to play a part in recovery. I'm not proposing to deal with every person or influence, but with those who are closely linked by providence in the development. These things are, in the words of Dr. Lloyd-Jones, a living illustration of the fact that out of the smallest, almost despicably, beginnings, God can bring a great power into being. Well, the first main heading is David Martin Lloyd-Jones and preaching. The doctor, as he was affectionately known, was undoubtedly the leading figure and the linchpin in the movement. We look at how he was brought to an understanding of these truths. He was born on 20th December 1899 in Cardiff, where his father was a shopkeeper. When he was five, the family moved to Llangaitho, the scene of the ministry of the famous Daniel Rowlands. At the age of nine, he survived a fire in the family store by being thrown from an upstairs window into a blanket below. An experience you remember similar to John Wesley. The first impressions made on the young lad was at the meeting of the Summer Association of the Calvinistic Methodists, which were held at Llangaitho in 1913 for the bicentenary of Daniel Rowland's birth. He later wrote for his biography, as Lloyd-Jones, "That association had a deep effect upon me, and possibly the most important thing it did was to create in me an interest in the Calvinistic Methodist fathers, which has lasted until this day." Just a few weeks after that experience, as he stood in the playground of Tregaron School at the end of the summer term, his history master, S.M. Powell, thrust something into his pocket with the abrupt instruction, "Read that." It was a booklet on the ministry of Howell Harris, one of the foremost figures in the 18th century revival in Wales. This was his first reading in the history of Calvinistic Methodism, a history from which he was to gain a distinct view of the majesty and power of God. In 1914, his father went to London to find work and bought a small dairy business in Westminster. He attended the Welsh Calvinistic Methodist Church at Charing Cross. Martin attended Marylebone Grammar School. At the age of 16, he began to study medicine at Barts. He graduated at the age of 21, caught the eye of the King's physician, Sir Thomas Horder, who invited him to become his assistant. The change in his life took place in the years 1925 to 26. Eternal realities faced him through the death of his brother and then his father. He also began to discern in his medical work that the real malady lay not in men's bodies, but in their minds and wills. He discovered that he himself was no different. As well as knowing conviction of sin and a profound sense of unworthiness, he drank at the fountainhead of divine love. It was entirely God's doing. I've known what it is to be filled with joy unspeakable and full of glory. It was at that time of his conversion that he discovered the English Puritans. His attention was drawn to an advert in the British Weekly for a new edition of the autobiography of Richard Baxter. It's interesting how Baxter comes into it. It comes in with Dr. Packer as well. His discovery of Baxter was followed by other 17th century acquisitions purchased in second-hand bookshops in London, presents on friends at his wedding, including a second-hand set of the works of John Owen. So now you know what to give to anyone who's getting married. In the course of time, Owen was preferred to Baxter. The doctor was ready to confess in 1971 that love for the Puritan authors governed his whole ministry. It is by no means unknown that those who become ministers through the gospel should have a sense of that calling given to them before they are converted. Such was the case with Lloyd Jones. He found himself in the throes of a struggle over whether or not it was right to abandon medicine. By June 1926, the struggle was over. It was God's hand that laid hold of me and drew me out and separated me to this work. He believed that he was not meant to pursue his denomination's course of theological education. He was preoccupied with the need for evangelistic work among poor, working-class people. After a talk with his minister, he was directed to the Home Mission Agency of the Calvinistic Methodist Church in Wales, known as the Forward Movement, an attempt to reverse the dwindling influence of the denomination upon the unchurch. He became the minister of Bethel Reform Movement Mission Hall in Sandfields, a locality of South Wales, of the South Wales mining town of Aberavon. Almost immediately things began to happen and conversions multiplied. It could be described as a localized revival. It was during his time in Sandfields that he became acquainted with new authors. He obtained the complete works of Jonathan Edwards in 1929. I was like the man in our Lord's parable who found a pearl of great price. Their influence upon me I cannot put into words. The discovery in 1932, while he was in America, of the 10-volume set of the works of B.B. Warfield was also a great stimulus to him. In 1938, tired and overworked in Sandfields, he accepted an offer by Dr. Campbell Morgan to share the pulpit at Westminster Chapel for 6 months while recovering and considering his future. In the end, this arrangement continued until Lloyd Jones became sole pastor in 1943. He was to remain there until 1968, a ministry of 30 years that was to have a profound effect on the future of the church. I want to mention an incident that took place in 1949 that illustrates the providential link-up of the men used by God. Dr. Lloyd-Jones was unwell with persistent catarrh and other symptoms of overwork. He had to cancel a visit to the USA and went to his beloved Wales on holiday. He suffered from depression and experienced an onslaught from the devil. It gave him a discovery of himself and of the pride of the human heart. He went to a nursing home near Bristol. The inner tempest continued. He had with him some of the writings of A.W. Pink. He woke one morning and was deeply conscious of the devil's presence in his room, and he could not get away from him. Then as he started dressing, he was on his own, and at the very moment when his eye caught just a word in a sermon of Pink's, the word was glory. And instantly, like a blaze of light, he felt the very glory of God surround him. Every doubt and every fear was silenced. The love of God was shed abroad in his heart. He was brought into a state of ecstasy and joy, which remained with him for several days. That experience helped to mold the ministry of Dr. Lloyd-Jones. He came to know himself and the wiles of the devil. The hallmark of a true experience of God is a sense of awe and accompanying a sense of unworthiness. He would say the final explanation of the church today is a defective sense of sin and a defective doctrine of sin. There was a change in his preaching, more of the experimental. He increasingly saw that truth is to be preached in a manner which affects the heart and the conscience. He urged that fellowship with God is more than orthodoxy. Love to God, a love which wholly possesses us, is the supreme need. That was an experience that shaped his ministry. After the difficulties and discouragements of the war years, the church began to grow. By 1947, the lower balcony of the church at Westminster had to be opened. The Friday night discussion classes had grown, and during 1953 to 1955, they took the form of expositions of Christian doctrine. I actually possess the notes of these expositions. This was followed by the exposition of Romans, which lasted from 1955 to 1968. We don't advocate any of you to follow that example. The numbers grew and the chapel became a centre for true biblical preaching, but also for many related interests that were destined to be influential in the recovery of the Reformed faith. I could mention the tremendous influence that he had in student work. If you trace through all that he did in IVF, UCCF, International Fellowship of Evangelical Students, he gave a great impetus to work among students. He became influential with the encouragement of ministers through the Westminster Fellowship. It began as early as 1941 as a quarterly Tuesday morning meeting intended for pastors and men in positions of Christian leadership. Men like Alan Stibbs and Philip Edgecombe Hughes joined it in 1942. Later it shifted to a Monday, the first Monday of the month, and consisted of a morning and afternoon session. So that's Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones and the beginnings of the work in his life and ministry. Then his second main influence is Geoffrey Williams and the Evangelical Library. The main factor in the link-up was Geoffrey Williams and the Evangelical Library. On a certain day in 1903, Geoffrey Williams, at the request of a schoolgirl, went to a service at Galeed Chapel, Brighton, where the preacher was the Reverend J.K. Popham. There he heard the gospel and was converted. Popham encouraged him to read good books. After a while, he began collecting books and had the vision for a library. Mr. Williams was later to recall those early days. When I began collecting books for this undertaking, the Puritan authors were one of my two chief quests. The other was for books on true revivals of religion, and in particular the Great Awakening in the 19th century under George Whitefield, Daniel Rowlands, Howell Harris, and other like-minded men. I had a burden for revival, and I will never forget the cries that went up to God as I walked along the railway bank pathway near the spot where the idea of this now worldwide library first came to me. The books were accommodated first in his home, then in a garage, then in a few do-it-yourself sheds, later in a brick building at Beddington. A small group of men united for the purpose, pastors who came to the Providence Chapel at Beddington, and in 1933, the Beddington Free Grace Library was established. The story of how the library came to be in London is the first link with Dr. Lloyd-Jones. On a certain day in 1938, Mr. Williams was walking down Great Portland Street in London. He went into a chemist's shop to make a small purchase. The owner, Mr. John Phillips, was a Welshman who was a member of the Charing Cross Calvinistic Methodist Chapel. I was attracted by his Welsh accent, and getting into conversation with him, I opened my heart to him in regard to the difficulty I faced with the library. He at once exclaimed, "Why, you must meet Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. His interest will be aroused, and he will suggest a way out. I will tell him about your project." That day was the turning point in the life of Mr. Williams and the library. Mr. Phillips fulfilled his word, and not long after that, Dr. Lloyd-Jones made a visit to Beddington. He was intending to stay a few minutes, but he spent 2.5 hours inspecting the contents. I felt that I was in the precise position of the Queen of Sheba on the occasion of her visit to Solomon. His one criticism was the location. It should be somewhere in the heart of London, within easy reach and access. After various obstacles had been cleared, the books in the Beddington Library were transported to London and housed at premises in 55 Gloucester Road, South Kensington, for an annual rent of £70. A trust deed was drawn up and the collection renamed the Evangelical Library. The inaugural meeting was on 15 January 1945, when a doctor said, "It's the founder's desire, in which we fully concur, that this library should become not a museum, but a living force." So 25,000 titles, many of them of a type which before the war had been scarcely saleable, were now within easy access in London. The subscription was 6 shillings and 6 pence, and by VE Day, 250 people had joined the library. Ian Murray and the Banner of Truth. The next significant movement to be connected with Dr. Lloyd-Jones came through Ian Murray and the Banner of Truth. Ian Murray was born in Lancashire in 1931 and was educated at the Isle of Man and Durham University. In the late 1940s, he attended conferences at Hildenborough Hall, where the well-known evangelist Tom Rees had his base. It was there that Ian first heard the gospel and met his future wife, Jean. In the Christian Union at Durham University, he had heard such men as Professor R.A. Finlayson of the Free Church College in Edinburgh. Indeed, there was a reawakening of the Puritans and Jonathan Edwards among some of the students at that time. Ian was accepted as a student for the ministry with the Liverpool Presbytery of the English Presbyterian Church. Such a thing no longer exists, although we're glad that there's a better such church now in England. He was called up to the national service, and this took him to the Far East. While there, he developed an interest in good books and was introduced to the writings of Robert Murray McChane. A missionary in Singapore, perceiving his interest, encouraged him to call at the home of Mr. William Blatchley at 27 Lancefield Street, Kilburn, in London, where he would find a good supply of the best second-hand Christian literature. When Ian arrived at the address, he was greeted by a gentleman who informed him that it was a few years since Mr. Blatchley had gone home. This man had commenced a ministry in Christian literature in 1887 or 88 in what was his parents' home. The man who greeted Ian was Mr. Hobbs, who had joined Mr. Blatchley in 1933. On the upper floor, Mr. Hobbs worked as a tailor for a livelihood, while downstairs his Christian ministry took the form of an Eldorado of second-hand Christian literature. It was in the rooms at Lancefield Street that Ian Murray first saw some of the titles that were later to be published by the Banner of Truth Trust, and obtained copies of books of such authors as Owen, Flavel, Bridges and Spurgeon. Mr. Hobbs gave advice on what to buy, and between 1951 and 1954, the reading of such books were used to set Ian on the path that led to the publication of the Banner magazine. In 1954, Ian was staying in London at the Foreign Missions Club in Highbury, principally to be able to sit under the ministry of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, whom he got to know. In December, he bought a rich haul of books from Mr. Hobbs. having with that finished off his savings, which kept him in London, he returned to his parents' home in Cheshire with his future entirely unknown, having severed his connections with him as a student for the ministry of the English Presbyterian Church. In 1955, March 1955, an invitation came from the man whose help was to be decisive in the start of the Banner of Truth magazine. Sidney Norton was ministering in a small charge, numbering not more than 24 people, at St. John's in Somerton in Oxford. The beliefs he proclaimed had much more in common with Oxford's spiritual past than with its present. He persuaded Ian to join him in the work, and after his marriage to Jean in April, the young couple moved to Oxford next month. The prevailing indifference to the Reformation truths in Oxford was the means of deepening concern for the recovery and dissemination of the doctrines of grace. Ian writes, "Close at hand, buildings, libraries and monuments were reminders of those eras when from Oxford's ancient colleges the doctrine of grace flowed to the whole nation. Those former days of power, along with the truths which then moved multitudes, all seemed forgotten amidst arid academic theology and a modern evangelism which seemed to know nothing of William Tyndale, John Owen or George Whitfield." Mr. Norton was not a popular preacher, but he was a man of prayer and faith. He was strong and articulate in his Calvinistic convictions. He had a burden for the recovery of truths that made salvation a work of divine grace. This was a burden which Ian shared, and the pair looked to the republication of an older Christian literature as a means to that end. Prayer was made for this, and when Mr. Norton unexpectedly received a gift of £40, it was put aside for the issue of a magazine. The two men started work, and the magazine went to press in July. Ian had planned to name it Gospel Banner, but Mr. Norton, with a compelling motivation of Psalm 60, verses 3-4, prevailed in naming it the Banner of Truth. After a delay at the printers, the first issue appeared in September 1955. The whole 20-page issue was on white paper. The 6-page editorial was in the joint names of Sidney Norton and Ian, I-A-N, instead of I-I-N, Murray. The message to the reader on the last page is so closely attached to the previous article that it could be overlooked and taken for part of it. But this is what it says. "According to the measure in which we are enabled, our desire is to continue to propagate truth as fully, widely, and as often as possible. There are great stores of written treasure, amassed by God's servants in past generations, now lying buried under the dust of time. We wish to unearth this treasure and spread it far and wide on the printed page. We earnestly solicit your prayerful attention." While assisting Mr. Norton, Ian was urged by Dr. Lloyd-Jones, given the facilities available at Oxford, to study the writings of the English reformers, and with a view to write a book to demonstrate the Calvinistic convictions of these men. The manuscript was finished in May 1956, by which time it was evident that the slender finances of the little congregation could no longer support an assistant. The outcome was Dr. Lloyd-Jones proposed that Ian come to Westminster Chapel as his assistant. This was approved at a church meeting on 12th July 1956, and the appointment began in September. The doctor's plan was for his assistant to lead meetings during the week, a prayer meeting on Monday and a Bible study on a Wednesday. By the time Ian arrived, the doctor had the idea that the Wednesday evening meeting should take the form of an address on church history. In that class was a man who would have stood out in any company. He was 6'4" in height, with jet black hair. He listened with rapt attention to Ian's lectures on the Reformers and the Puritans. Jack Cullum, as his name was a highly successful acoustic consultant. His business flourished due to his invention during the Second World War of mufflers to reduce the noise of jet aircraft when they were being tested on the ground. A nominal Methodist, he gave up attending church. A couple spoke of Christ to him on a transatlantic crossing in 1955. And not finding the right preaching in Methodist circles, he was directed to Westminster Chapel. In the same month, December 1955, he accepted an invitation to the home of the couple, where he was converted during a service. A couple in Jerusalem, I should say, they were in Jerusalem, and he went to a service and converted in Jerusalem. Amazing story. It was clear that Mr. Cullen wished to do something with his life. He invited Ian and Jean Murray to his home in Highgate. As they walked together on Hampstead Heath on January 26, 1957, Cullen put a question to Ian. Why is it that all the history and teaching of the English reformers and Puritans is so little known today? On hearing of the long period during which the works of these men had been unavailable through booksellers, Ian says that he had no idea he was speaking to someone whom God was calling to support the republication. By mid-March, plans were developed, and Dr. Lloyd-Jones gave his approval to a publishing work, which was also to be a charitable trust that year. And so began the work of the Banner of Truth Trust. Then we come to Dr. Packer and the Puritan Conference. The next link in the chain is Dr. James I. Packer. He was born in Gloucester in 1926. While a boy, he experienced a near-fatal accident, being hit with a bread van. The injury left him with a small hole in his right forehead. He was off school for 6 months and could not join in normal schoolboy activities. Being naturally introspective, he found solace in solitary things. He became something of a bookworm. Accompanying his father to the railway office on a Saturday, he was allowed to use a typewriter. When it came near to the time of his 11th birthday, he was dropping hints as he would like a bicycle. With his head injury, the parents knew it was not on. When the day came and the present was awaiting him in the dining room, it turned out to be a typewriter. It proved to be his best present and the most treasured possession of his boyhood. His parents were nominal Anglicans. The teaching he received before confirmation reflected a typical view of Tractarianism, which was the need for personal devotion, preparation for Holy Communion, and the importance of personal morality. He went to Oxford to study and attended OICU, that's the Christian Union. He was converted while listening to an address by a minister, rather obscure name, the Reverend Earl Langston. He made his commitment to Christ about 100 feet from where George Whitfield had done so in 1735. It was while feeling the tension between a specific way of understanding the Christian life and his own experience of that life that Packer came across the Puritans. C. Owen Pickard Cambridge, some name, an Anglican clergyman who was going blind, decided to gift his complete library to OICU. Nobody in OICU seemed to know what to do with these books. The senior librarian remembered that Packer was something of a bookworm, so he entrusted them to him. As Packer sorted out through the dusty piles of old books, he came across an uncut set of the writings of the Puritan John Owen, which had been published in 24 volumes by W.H. Gould during the years 1850 to 55. He was particularly struck by the titles on indwelling sin and the mortification of sin. Packer's assignment for a year to tutor in New Testament Greek in Oak Hill College, London, led him to Westminster Chapel. The preaching he heard there, he said, was like hearing a full orchestra after listening to a piano solo. Dr. Lloyd-Jones' ministry taught him the greatness of God and the greatness of the soul. Another student and close friend of Packer's from Oxford, doing further study in London, O. Raymond Johnson, was also at Westminster, and Johnson and him were both members of the Tyndall Fellowship for Biblical Research. And they found interest in the Puritans, and that made them have the idea of a conference with a particular focus on Puritan thought and life. It was clear that Lloyd-Jones was ideally placed to promote the venture if his support could be secured. Raymond Johnson seems to have been the spokesman who put the idea to the doctor. In the IVF magazine, The Christian Graduate, for September 1950, G.I. Packer wrote on the doctrinal Puritans and their work. He concentrated on the Puritans' thorough treatment of Christian experience. He contrasted, I should say, the Puritans' thorough treatment of Christian experience with an endemic subjectivity in much modern teaching on the Christian life. The article concluded with a low-key postscript, drawing brief attention to a conference to be held at Westminster Chapel, December 19th to 20th, 1950, under the general title, The Distinctive Theological Contribution of the English Puritans. That conference consisted of the reading of papers, followed by discussion periods often characterized by free and fierce debate. The first conference, the first conference had about 20 people. By the middle of the 1950s, 60 were attending, and by 1960, the number was in excess of 100. Dr. Lloyd-Jones chaired the sessions, and from 1960 onwards, invariably contributed the closing address. Through this conference, a rising generation of theological students and young ministers were being offered a powerful and pervasive vision of the Christian life, in which theology, biblical exposition, spirituality, and preaching were shown to be mutually indispensable and interrelated. Packer reflects 20 years later, "We did not think of ourselves as setting up a rallying point for a new movement. Although in retrospect, it now seems that this is what we did. We only knew that the dusty pages of Owen and Goodwin, mouldering on the bottom shelves of the Oiku Library, had become a gold mine to us, and we wanted to share the wealth." The doctor did all he could to encourage the tall, hard-working Packer and to support a widening of his influence. Only on one major aspect of the doctrine of salvation did a difference remain between them, namely on the extent of the atonement. Still sympathetic with Richard Baxter's universal view and working for a defill on Baxter at the time, Packer was silent on the issue at the Cambridge discussion of 1953, but he continued to think, and Dr. Lloyd-Jones was delighted at the outcome. This is what he says: "I will never forget one morning when the Puritan conference was due to start. Packer came rushing up to me and said, 'I'm now a complete Calvinist, doctor.' He had finished with Baxter and turned to Owen. At first," and this is Lloyd-Jones, "I alone was contending for limited atonement." Immersed in the Puritan writings, Packer became a powerful contemporary writer and made enormous contributions by his books, Fundamentalism and the Word of God, Evangelism and the Sovereignty of God, and perhaps the most powerful and revolutionary piece of writing to come from his pen was his introduction to the Banner's reprint of The Death of Death by John Owen. It caused a storm. The pages of The Life of Faith was full of correspondence. Popular evangelists like Tom Rees wrote against it. Even a doctor thought that Packer had gone too far. He thought his disciple had gone too far because he implied that Arminians were not Christians. Then the final man is John Murray in the Leicester Conference. The contribution that John Murray was to bring to the emerging Reform movement was the very epitome of Scottish Calvinistic piety together with Scottish/Princeton tradition and theology. John Murray was born in a godly home, Bad Bay, in the parish of Creagh, Sutherland, in the best days of Christianity in the Highlands. Under the ministry of George Rainey, 1771 to 1810, it is said that 100 men professed the work of grace in their lives. When a moderate minister was imposed on them in 1811, the congregation left the building and met on the shores of Loch Migdil under a great rock in all weathers. It was in these times of gospel power that Alexander Murray, his father, became an elder in the Free Church at the age of 27 and reared a family of 6 sons and 2 daughters. John was the youngest son, born in 1898. The home was overcrowded, the family were poor, but the greatest adornment was godliness and prayer. John Murray could say of his father, "I never witnessed a greater intensity of spiritual exercise of soul in any other person. His very body moved in sympathy with the inner man." If you, those of you who knew Professor Murray would know that it's also true of the son. Acquainted as he was to become with the men of Princeton and Westminster, he always maintained that the man who had the greatest influence on him was his father. He imbibed true piety in that home and parish, and as typical of other forms of others from such a background, could not pinpoint the day of his regeneration. After serving in World War I and being invalided out of after losing his right eye from shrapnel, he studied at Glasgow University and offered himself as a student for the ministry of the Free Presbyterian Church. He impressed his tutor so much that it was agreed he should complete his course at Princeton Seminary in the USA in order that he might become a future tutor in the Free Presbyterian Church. He completed his 2 years in Princeton and helped in preaching at Free Presbyterian congregations in North America. Now, one of the ministers of that church in North America, Mr. Matheson of Chesley, was in dispute with the church over the use of public transport on the Lord's Day. He didn't believe himself that you should take public transport on the Lord's Day, but he wouldn't debar anyone from the table who felt that they could do that. And Mr. Murray was sympathetic with the position taken by the minister, and as a result lost favour with the leaders of the FP Church and was ultimately denied licensing. That providence was a turning point in Murray's life, which led him away from his beloved Scotland and the FP Church to a sojourn of almost 40 years in the USA. He was invited to be assistant to Caspar Whisper Hodge in Princeton, but after a year there he accepted the invitation to join the newly formed Westminster Theological Seminary with J. Gresham Machen and others in the faculty due to the liberal teaching in Princeton. The unique contribution of his Scottish Calvinistic piety and his theological erudition gave a status to Westminster that was second to none in the Reformed world. His influence on generations of students is incalculable. He made them realize in a unique way, through his painstaking examination of the text of Scripture in the original languages, that the Reformed faith was biblical. But more than the quality of his own life, but more than that, the quality of his own life was reflected in his preaching and evangelism, and he showed that piety must burn in men's heart if they are to be effective preachers. It is in the mercy of God that John Murray's life was not confined to a small denomination in Scotland. His influence pervaded the Reformed world, and in the providence of God he was to return to influence not the Scottish church, but the English church scene. His coming to England in the 1950s coincided with a resurgence of interest in the Reformed faith. It was no doubt an answer to his prayers for the dawn of a better day in the United Kingdom. It was inevitable that those who had recently felt the power of the doctrines of grace should gravitate to him. John Murray then, in his full maturity, brought powerful corroboration and gave further momentum to the thinking that was bringing about a new departure in English evangelicalism. Professor Murray's first contact with the emerging movement was when he visited the Evangelical Library in the summer of 1945. His first speaking engagement in England was in 1953. Dr. Lloyd-Jones, as the president of the Evangelical Library, invited him to give the annual library lecture on Reformation principles. In July of the same year, he spoke at the fourth summer school of the Tyndale Fellowship. The chairman was Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, and the theme, the plan of salvation. Murray gave an address on definite redemption. The subject was a bombshell, and there was no senior man present in that audience to support Professor Murray but the chairman, Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. That was the state of things in that time. And when the first announcement of the work which the Banner of Truth planned to do in publications, they expressed their indebtedness to three men, Dr. Lloyd-Jones, Reverend W.J. Greer, and Professor John Murray. Among Professor Murray's chief concerns was for the restoration of true preaching. One who shared this view was the Reverend J. Marcellus Kick, a trustee of Westminster Seminary. The subject was discussed with Mr. Kick when he was present in London in 1961. As a result, he carried back to Professor Murray in Philadelphia a proposal that a conference should be held for ministers the following year in the UK, concentrating specifically on the need for a renewal of preaching. Other men were consulted about this, and among them was the Reverend W.J. Greer in Belfast, Northern Ireland. He was a fellow student of John Murray at Princeton. Mr. Greer had made a courageous stand against modernism in the Presbyterian Church in Northern Ireland and subsequently founded the Irish Evangelical Church, now the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. He had set up the Evangelical Bookshop, which even before the advent of the banner was supplying to readers in the UK good Reformed books imported from the USA. His church has had strong links with the Free Church of Scotland, sharing in the training of students for the ministry and missionary work. Another strand in the development was the interest of Reverend Kenneth A. McCrae, minister of the Free Church of Scotland in Stornoway in the Outer Hebrides, the largest Presbyterian congregation in the UK. He believed that he believed that there was no reason to fear that even in a denomination as evangelical as the Free Church, the distinctive Reformed testimony of the Church was to some extent being compromised by a weakening of principles. On this issue, he spoke more than once, and he also set his convictions in print in a 32-page booklet, The Resurgence of Arminianism, which he wrote on a voyage to Australia in 1953. Mr. McCrae longed and prayed for a recovery of truth and godliness and believed that the tide will turn. The advent of the Banner of Truth magazine in Oxford in September 1955 was an encouragement to him, and he personally ordered quantities of between 150 and 200 copies. He expressed further delight when a similar magazine, Eternal Truth, made its appearance in Edinburgh in April 1959. I'm delighted to receive the copy of Eternal Truth which you kindly sent me. One of the few favorable indications in our day of a turn in the tide is the surprising demand there is for the writings of the divines of the past, both in America and in this country. His initial order was for 40 copies, but they went so rapidly that another 40 was ordered, and his subsequent orders were for 150 copies. It was with the prospect of helping this work that he accepted the invitation to speak at the first ministers' conference organized under the Banner of Truth Trust. Although in his 79th year, he made a long journey from the Isle of Lewis to undertake what was his first and last preaching engagement in England, as well as speaking at the Leicester Conference. He took the communion services at the Free Church congregation in London and preached for the Reverend Ian Murray at Grove Chapel. It was in this way that the Lord in his goodness brought men from different countries and Reformed traditions together to apply themselves in the restoration of preaching, and so there was established the first Leicester Ministers' Conference. And I just want to conclude now with some assessment, it will be as brief as possible, of what happened. This work that we are speaking about was undoubtedly a work of God. The spontaneous manner in which the change had occurred bore the marks of a work of the Spirit of God. Swelling numbers was characteristic of the period 1955 to 1966. Numbers at the chapel increased continually. Students coming to the knowledge of Christ and embracing Reformed teaching increased. Young men were entering the ministry full of zeal. The Westminster Fellowship and the Puritan Conference had to move to larger halls in the chapel. As Ian Murray says, it was to a degree reminiscent of the days when John Knox could write of God raining men from heaven. There was an air of excitement at what was happening. Secondly, the debt we owe to Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. There was quite a time in which he stood alone. There is an account in the biography of the change that took place in the thinking of Professor Tasker, and after an address on the wrath of God, the doctor said to Edwin King, "I think he's a very lonely man in need of fellowship." Later, King was talking to Tasker after a service at the chapel and mentioned the doctor's concern, to which Tasker replied, I think he's speaking of his own heart's experience. He is a lonely man." Dr. Lloyd-Jones stood against the ecumenical movement, cooperative campaign evangelism, the Keswick teaching, refusing invitations to speak at the convention. He stood alone on limited atonement. He grew encouragement from the younger men. We hear criticisms of the doctor by young men, especially on his views of the baptism of the Spirit. Yes, he was not right on everything, but where would we be without him today? And what did he and others recover? Well, they recovered first of all that true Christianity is God-centered religion. The church was delivered from a man-centered gospel. It was said that there were three eminent preachers in London, Soper, Weatherhead, and Lloyd-Jones. Soper, he preaches love. Weatherhead, he preaches Jesus. That man at Westminster, what does he preach? He preaches God. He caught the vision of God in his glory that Warfield spoke of. Of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever. Sovereign in creation and providence and redemption. It's all of grace. He taught us what it means to be a gospel minister. Great decay in the position of the minister. In the early part of the century, there was a kind of a worldly profession. It happened before. It happened in the priests in the Old Testament. What did God do? He called men from unexpected places. Elijah, Amos. In church history, it's the same. And he called Lloyd-Jones from a highly successful medical career to a salary of £225 a year in poverty-stricken Sandfields. He believed what he preached. He had confidence in the message. The soul is more important than the body. He gave us a recovery of what it means to be a gospel preacher. He handed on that testimony to the generations to come. But also, he taught us what it means to preach. He recovered the Calvin view of preaching. True preaching is God acting. What is preaching, he asked? Logic on fire. Eloquent reason. It is theology on fire. Theology is preaching coming through a man who is on fire. What is the chief end of preaching? It is to give men and women a sense of God and his presence. And at that, Dr. Lloyd-Jones and Professor John Murray were at one. And then, fourthly, the importance of understanding the times in which we live. The doctor saw early on that the real problem is not with the world, but with the church. Both in his charges in Sandfields and in Westminster, this truth was emphasized. The health of the church has always been in proportion to the extent in which our teaching, the difference between a Christian and a non-Christian, has been kept sharp and clear. Once the line is blurred, spiritual decline is a certainty. This is why he laid such emphasis on the need of the Holy Spirit and revival. It was the burden of his ministry. And it's not surprising when he saw some flickerings of new life, even in non-reformed wings of the church, that he rejoiced. He was always warning us against head knowledge and intellectualism. Now you might say, I haven't criticized anything about the movement. Well, what happened was that the 1950s saw the concentration on the recovery of the doctrines of grace. The early 1960s saw a shift to matters concerning the doctrine of the church. Ministers were leaving their mixed denominations. What should they do? The 1964 and 1965 Leicester Ministers' Conference were devoted to these issues. There was a doctor's view that you could unite the evangelical doctrines of salvation. There was Professor Murray's view that the minimal was not right. The church ought to confess that truth revealed to her and enshrined in our great confessions. And we are to unite in that. The matter could not be resolved. And that issue dogged the reform movement for quite a number of years. And in despair, as it were, of getting agreement, the banner went back. In 1967, restarted the Banner of Truth Conference, and it emphasized experimental Calvinism with Al Martin as a rising star. Well, what are the consolations? People say, well, what's become of our movement? We have received a rich heritage of Reformed literature, which hopefully will not be lost again. It is sustaining ministers and students and the Christians in the pew in difficult days. The influence, secondly, of the work has spread beyond our wildest dreams. All around the world, people are reading these books in their own language. In recent days, the 14th volume of Lloyd Jones on Romans was published in Korean. Brazil beat Korea in getting the 14th volume into Portuguese. In China, the Reformed books are multiplying. And thirdly, there are many more Reformed ministers than there were before. They come together in conferences, they read these books, and they get help in discouraging days. Thank God for men like Dr. Lloyd-Jones and John Murray, who are God-fearers and God-centered in their thinking, and whose preaching did not court the favor of the world or the compromised church, who did not seek to be clever theologians, but called us back to God's truth and godliness, and sought above everything else the favor and blessing of God. Let us not betray the work that they began.